WMR.
Point Reyes Station.
I'm Emily Henderson.
And I'm Peter Henderson.
We listen to KWMR.
All the way from Brighton in England.
Media support for KWMR is provided by the Point Reyes Light, family-owned since 1948. Information on classified subscriptions, advertising, and more at ptreyeslight.com or at 415-669-1200.
KWMR is supported by our listener members and by Good Earth Natural Foods, online at genatural.com. That's genatural.com.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Houghton. Coming up on As It Happens...
A seismic shift. Protesters fill Iran's streets after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini. She'd been arrested for wearing what the country's morality police called an improper hijab. As demonstrators clash with authorities, one expert says it could finally, slowly, lead to meaningful change.
And no false moves. Well, in this case, almost no moves at all. The chess world is stunned again after world champion Magnus Carlsen quits a match with a young American phenom after a single move amid suggestions that the upstart may be cheating.
Those stories and more coming up for you on this Tuesday edition of As It Happens. Hi, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening. I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Saving face while losing ground. In a week of stunning Ukrainian advances, the Kremlin claims it's just regrouping. But an advisor to Ukraine's defense minister says Vladimir Putin's forces won't be given that chance.
Come high water, then hell. Flooding in Pakistan has destroyed farmers' fields and livestock, raising the very real specter of widespread hunger in that country and beyond.
A loss for wards. Thousands of nurses go on strike in Minnesota. They're demanding better working conditions. One striking ICU nurse tells us COVID's Delta wave was the hardest and most harrowing time of her career.
Wish yours was here. Our morning trip down the dusty driveway to the AIH mailbox yields a handful of postcards, and we'll share them with you in the hopes that you will share one with us.
A mixing blessing. For 30 years, the late Thomas Carney tended bar at the famous New York hotspot Elaine's, and a former regular tells us he was a classic Big Apple barkeep who was never shaken and rarely stirred.
And Owl's Well That Ends Well. More than 20 years after she was snatched from a PEI theme park, a robotic bird named Mrs. Henrietta Sleepy Owl is mysteriously returned. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that's sure her replacement is upset, but you know, Hooter's gonna hoot. Ukraine appears to have rattled the country's Russian invaders. Earlier this month, the Ukrainian government announced a counteroffensive, but no one, least of all the Russian army, expected the scale or the speed of the attack. President Volodymyr Zelensky now says that in barely over a week, his country's forces have retaken thousands of square kilometers that it took the Russians months to seize. And in Russia, the stories of casualties and abandoned equipment have even the Kremlin's most vocal supporters demanding answers. Yuri Sack is an advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Defense. We reached him in Kyiv.
Mr. Sack, the Kremlin says today Russian forces are simply, quote, regrouping. How would you describe Ukraine's military, what it's accomplished over the past week?
Over the past week, Ukrainian army was able to regain control of over 6,000 square kilometers of the temporarily occupied territory, the territory that was occupied by the aggressor, the Russian Federation. Now, of course, this is a major setback for the Russian army since perhaps the retreat of the Russian army from the Kyiv region earlier in April. And we're not surprised that they're trying to cover up this humiliation by coming up with some creative terminology. But the reality is such that the Russian army is fleeing. They're fleeing chaotically. We have been able to, pretty much every hour, Ukrainian armed forces have been regaining control over more and more villages and localities. We have destroyed almost 3,000 Russian soldiers during this counteroffensive. We have destroyed hundreds of Russian tanks and armored vehicles. We have captured hundreds of Russian tanks and armored vehicles. So this was a counteroffensive blitzkrieg, which resulted in major success for the Ukrainian army and major setback for the Russian army.
You know, all of the advances you've made to this point do come at a cost. You mentioned the boost to morale for Ukrainian soldiers, but how long can you and Ukraine soldiers sustain what they're doing?
Look, for us, for Ukrainian people, for Ukrainian army, we don't have a choice. The only choice that we have, we either win this war or we are extinguished, right? Because the aggressor has said it many times publicly that their goal is ultimately the destruction of the Ukrainian nation as such. So for us, we will go till the very end, till we win this war. And we are confident that we will win this war because we are not fighting it alone. We are supported in our fight by our international partners, because all of them, they understand that while the war is taking place on the Ukrainian territory, on the Ukrainian soil, at the same time, this is a war for the European values. This is a war for the future of the European freedom. So this is why we're not alone in this fight. We'll go till the very end, and we will win in the end.
There are reports that U.S. and British military helped Ukraine in this, that they were instrumental in helping form the strategy that Ukrainian forces ultimately deployed, that part of the shift and part of this new success is due to the fact the Ukrainian military was open to that cooperation and strategizing together. Is that true? What can you tell me about that?
All issues related to Ukraine's military strategy are decided exclusively by the General Staff of the Ukrainian Armed Forces. And the General Staff of the Ukrainian Armed Forces has not confirmed any of the issues that you have just raised and referred to. But at the same time, it is not a secret that the Ukrainian armed forces are cooperating with our international partners, with NATO. There's a lot of exchange of reconnaissance and information. We are receiving military support in the form of weaponry from our Western partners. So while it is not possible to confirm that the exact planning was taking place for this counteroffensive, the cooperation between the Ukrainian army and our Western allies has been ongoing pretty much from the first day of this war.
The Kremlin spokesperson Dmytro Peskov says Russia will continue in Ukraine, quote, until the tasks that were initially set have been fulfilled. What do you say to Mr. Peskov tonight?
I don't want to say anything to Mr. Peskov because he's been saying so much ludicrous statements, during the past 7 months that it's wrong to believe him, but or trust him. But what we can say is that Russia's objectives, which they have set for themselves at the beginning, have not been met at all. So they've suffered one setback after another. Of course, they have captured some of the Ukrainian territory, but we are gradually regaining it. But their major objective, for example, to gain full control of Luhansk and Donetsk region, they have not achieved that, right? At the beginning, they were planning to capture Kyiv within 3 days. They failed. They were forced to retreat. So far, they have not been able to achieve any significant military success. But what they are capable of is, of course, the missile terror, because for the last, for example, 24 hours, Ukrainian cities again were struck with Russian missiles. And Russians are striking, while they're unable to achieve success on the battlefield, they're striking civilian infrastructure. So they struck, for example, the power plants in Kharkiv. And as a result, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have been left without electricity, schools, kindergartens, hospitals. So this all shows that Russia is a terrorist state, and it should be recognized as a state sponsor of terrorism.
Given that duality that you mentioned, on one hand, these recent advances and military successes, but the strikes that you just listed, how are people in Kyiv, where you are, feeling?
Well, people in Kyiv, as well as in other Ukrainian cities, of course, you know, by now we are all very resilient. The government is very cautious, and it keeps repeating that, you know, if air raid sirens ring out, then people should seek shelter. But for now, there is a sense of confidence in Kyiv and in other Ukrainian cities that we will win this war. Everybody supports the Ukrainian army, and everybody's looking forward to, you know, to restoring peace.
Mr. Sack, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yuri Sack is an advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Defense. We reached him in Kyiv.
It just hasn't been good. To not feel valued it's not okay. And people just don't know how not okay things are.
That was Minnesota nurse Brandy Navarro speaking with a CNN reporter yesterday while wearing a red bow in her hair and a red cape. She was dressed like a superhero, which is what people called healthcare workers like her throughout the pandemic. But as you heard her say there, she does not feel valued, which is part of the reason she joined thousands of other nurses on the streets of Minnesota yesterday, on the first day of a 3-day strike. It's being called one of the largest private sector nurse strikes in U.S. history. Brianna Nath is an ICU nurse in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. She's part of the Minnesota Nurses Association's contract action team, and we reached her in Anoka.
Brianna, what do you think when you hear Brandy Navarro speaking there, clearly trying to hold back her tears?
Yeah, I think, you know, what she said is exactly how we all feel. We have gone from being these heroic essential people for the last couple of years to being just, you know, disrespected by our employers, and our opinions and our expertise don't really matter anymore. And that's why we're out on the streets right now picketing for a better contract.
What was it like at the strike you were at yesterday?
Yeah, so I was at my hospital, North Memorial, yesterday, and to use the word great is a hard word to say about being on strike, but it was really empowering, and I was so proud to be out there with my fellow nurses because we have worked so hard over the last 6 months and trying to get a better contract and just continually getting met with stonewalls at the negotiation table. So to get all of us out there walking the line together, all fighting for the same thing, it was pretty incredible to see and to be part of that.
When you say you don't feel that you're respected or your expertise or your efforts, you know, that they're not appreciated, what kinds of things are you experiencing that have pushed you to this point?
I would say that we are just asked to do more and more with less and less. It's not uncommon every day for our hospital to be down anywhere from 5 to 10 nurses every shift. And if they can't get those holes filled by people picking up on their days off, then we are asked to take a larger assignment, which means, you know, it's just more room for error, more room for not great care. And that's not what we want to provide. We want to provide excellent care to our patients and treat them as if they are our family members. You know, my own family goes to North Memorial. We want to be treating people as best we can. And when we're limited like that, we just can't do it anymore.
You're an ICU nurse. We're talking about life and death situations here. And you've described the Delta wave of COVID as the hardest time in your career. Can you describe what a day on the job was like at that time?
For the first time in the entire COVID pandemic, I finally had a breaking point. I was crying after my shifts and just so disheartened by what was happening in healthcare. I took care of so many people that were in their 20s. Most of them were unvaccinated and just so, so sick.
That was the impact of COVID, but the nursing issues you've described, how did they impact your patients?
Yes, of course. we lost a lot of nurses throughout the last couple of years. So we continued to work short staffed through that Delta wave specifically, where we were asked to pick up extra shifts or asked to stay late or come early. It meant, you know, you maybe would get into a patient room for a period of time, but would have to skip out on some of the things you would normally do, like maybe brushing that person's hair or brushing their teeth or, you know, dotting all your I's and your T's to make sure everything was done perfectly as you normally would have done, because you just simply didn't have the time. You needed to get into another room to do the same thing for the other patient. We didn't have enough people to help with simple things along with big things.
And when you say you lost a lot of nurses, did they quit?
Yes.
Because of the working situation, the conditions?
Yes. Yep.
You've described a bit of why you and your colleagues think this strike is necessary. What are you demanding? What do you want? Your contract expired in May, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, our contract expired May 31st. We get a new contract every 3 years. And of course, this last contract, we experienced a lot of hardship. And this is our opportunity to stand up and fight for what is right in the nursing profession. I would say the main things that I'm currently very passionate about are our scheduling and our staffing grids. You know, right now we're just treated as a nurse, as a nurse, as a nurse, and we're all put into this scheduling thing, and you have to fit into this perfect puzzle, and it's not based on who you are or what you do or what your family is. You just have to fill the hole. We don't have any real control over our scheduling. People are rotating shifts at 50%, so working nights and days kind of back to back. It's just been incredibly hard. And these are things we've been fighting for months to get corrected. And we're just, you know, no one really seems to care at the other end of the table.
Some of the hospital systems involved, they've said your union has rushed to strike, refused mediation, and is demanding unrealistic wage increases. How do you respond to that?
Oh, that makes my blood boil. We definitely did not rush to a strike. We have been in contract negotiations since March. The hospital I work for, we have had 19 sessions, and we have made very few tentative agreements. So I don't think that it has been rushed at all. I know that we have been blamed for this strike by the hospitals as well. And I adamantly, I just think that's terrible for them to say. They have not come to the table in good faith. They have not offered us a fair contract.
The union says 15,000 nurses walked off the job yesterday, but where does that leave the patients who you say are already underserved?
Well, they, I believe, you know, we did give a 10-day strike notice, so the hospitals had that opportunity to find travel nurses or replacement nurses. I don't know what's going on inside the hospital. I am very hopeful that they're being well cared for. I know that there's a lot of management that has been there 24/7 during this. I really hope the best for everyone there. I know that, you know, what we do is incredibly important, and these are people's lives on the line. I want to be back in there, and I'm hoping on Thursday morning we can all return.
You know, we're certainly hearing about nurses upset with conditions here, people in the medical profession in Canada as well. The burnout is not just in your state. Do you have a sense that you think you'll see more strikes like this in your country and here in Canada?
I do. I think that this could be the beginning of some really empowering movements throughout all of labor, really. I heard that the railway might be going on strike as well pretty soon. I think, you know, we just, people need to stand up for their rights and proper working conditions. And if this is how it has to be done, it's very unfortunate. But we have to make some changes to make these professions stand tall again and be the noble professions that they are.
Brianna, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Brianna Nath is an ICU nurse at North Memorial Hospital in Minnesota. We reached her in Anoka. He no longer wants it, but today shareholders voted to approve Elon Musk's $44 billion offer to buy Twitter. That vote followed dramatic Senate testimony also today from former Twitter security chief Peter Zatko, who took the opportunity to expand on a complaint he'd shared with regulators and The Washington Post this summer, alleging widespread security issues at the company.
I'm here today because Twitter leadership is misleading the public, lawmakers, regulators, and even its own board of directors. What I discovered when I joined Twitter was that this enormously influential company was over a decade behind industry security standards. The company's cybersecurity failures make it vulnerable to exploitation, causing real harm to real people. And when an influential media platform can be compromised by teenagers, thieves, and spies, and the company repeatedly creates security problems on their own, this is a big deal for all of us. When I brought concrete evidence of these fundamental problems to the executive team and repeatedly sounded the alarm of the real risks associated with them, and these were problems brought to me by the engineers and employees of the company themselves, the executive team chose instead to mislead its board, shareholders, lawmakers, and the public instead of addressing them. This leads to two obvious questions. Why did they do that? And what were the problems and vulnerabilities identified? And that's what I'm here to talk about. So first, why did they do that? To put it bluntly, Twitter leadership ignored its engineers because key parts of leadership lacked the competency to understand the scope of the problem. But more importantly, their executive incentives led them to prioritize profits over security. Upton Sinclair famously said, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." This mentality is exactly what I saw at the executive level at Twitter. So what are the problems I discovered? Two basic issues. First, they don't know what data they have, where it lives, or where it came from, and so, unsurprisingly, they can't protect it. And this leads to the second problem, which is the employees then have to have too much access to too much data and to too many systems. You can think of it this way, which is it doesn't matter who has keys if you don't have any locks on the doors.
That was Peter Zatko, former head of security for Twitter, testifying before the U.S. Senate today. Before it closed down in 2005, the Rainbow Valley Amusement Park on Prince Edward Island was famous for a lot of things. Its water slides, its spooky cave, its roller coaster, and the delicious, greasy food visitors struggled to keep down after the roller coaster. And it was also famous for its talking, hooting, animatronic owl, Mrs. Henrietta Sleepy Owl, who greeted visitors. Until one fateful day in the year 2000, when she was mysteriously taken from her perch. She was replaced with a less animated version, and the whereabouts of the original Henrietta remained a mystery. Until recently, when she showed up on the doorstep of a former employee after 22 years. John Davison's family owned and operated Rainbow Valley. We reached him in Kensington, PEI.
So, John, just what is so special about Mrs. Henrietta Sleepy Owl?
Well, Mrs. Owl was a fixture at Rainbow Valley, which was an amusement park here in PEI, from 1969 to 2005. The owl was one of the stops that the children just loved to make. They like to give their stories to the owl and tell her knock knock jokes
and she's pretty high tech for that time, right? Yeah. She had a moving head, a beak, and spoke, as you said. What kind of things would she say to the kids?
She did. Well, she'd, again, like if the kids wanted to tell knock-knock jokes, she knew all the good ones. She would ask them if they had been on the water slides at the park or if they were going over to the magic show. And they always wanted to, if they went somewhere after and they said we had a great time on the little roller coaster, they would come back over and tell Mrs. Owl, "You were right, we had fun." And she was just a friend to them while they were at the park.
So why do you think someone would steal her?
Maybe they just needed a friend.
That's a very nice way of looking at it. Well, if they needed a friend, they kept her for a long time. We're talking 22 years.
They did keep her for a long while. It was a typical morning at the park that day. It was July of 2000, and of course the operator went in and the doors opened up and proceeded to talk to the children on the doorstep, and the kids said, you know, well, where are you, Mrs. Howell? Well, she said, I'm right here in front of you. Well, are you invisible? I can't see you. And that was the first notification that anybody had that that there was an owl missing that day. So we promptly had to fill the space with a replacement owl, as one does. And we, for 22 years, never had an inkling that she was out there somewhere still.
So then you get a text from a friend who's also a former employee of the amusement park.
Yeah, my friend in Summerside sends me a text with a picture of an owl in a box, and he says, "Does this look familiar to you?" And I had to kind of shocked because I mean, number one, I knew he didn't work with us before the owl went missing, so there was no possibility of having a picture of the owl. And I said, "Yeah, that's the owl that went missing well over 20 years ago," and. He said, yeah, I found it in the box at the end of my driveway this morning.
Someone had just delivered it, and there was a note in the box, right?
There was the top of the box just said, for return to Rainbow Valley. And then once we pulled the owl out of the box, she had penned a beautiful letter to tell us about her travels.
Oh, the owl had penned the letter. Okay, do you want to read it to us?
She said, "Dear Earl, over 20 years ago, I flew the coop, one might say, and found a beautiful family of friends who took me in and looked after me. I got the chance to spread my wings and fly all over the Maritimes, from Nova Scotia to New Brunswick, but of course I've never left my true home of PEI. I have attended music festivals, parties, and special family events all over our beautiful Maritimes. To keep my fans from recognizing me, I would attend incognito. After a beautiful life with friends who loved me like family and whom I will never forget, it's time for me to come home again and see all of my fans once again. Let my return home be a symbol of peace, love, unity, and respect in a time when we could all use it. Love, Mrs. Henrietta the Owl."
Mrs. Henrietta the Owl is quite a poet. How's her penmanship?
She's got impeccable penmanship. Absolutely beautiful.
There's some clues in there. Is this something you want to investigate further? Do you want to find out, or do you know already who she was hanging out with all this time?
I really don't know. I mean, I had a couple maybe suspicions over the years, but I really have no idea who she was with. And at this time, I think we're all just happy to have her home safe again. I mean, she wouldn't have had the experiences that she had without that person to intervene.
That's true. And maybe her chats with potential visitors from now on will reflect those visits. Who knows? You mentioned Earl. That's your dad. He designed
and built
the owl. So what does he think now that she's back?
He's quite pleased to have the owl returned. I think if anybody could issue a pardon to the culprits, I think he'd be more than happy to.
And your mom, we should mention, it was the first voice of Mrs.
Yes, mom was the first one of the owls. It was a sort of a trial project that they had put together, you know, originally, and of course, mom got sort of mentioned that day. Well, you come down to the park today. You're going to be operating the owl, and she said, "I'm going to be doing the what?" And so she became the template for what a good owl should be.
Obviously, this means a lot to your family. It's a great story. So what plans are there for her now?
Well, I have a haunted house here in Kensington, and you're always looking for help for workers. And these days, labor shortage, just all that. I guess we could take an elderly retired owl and maybe put her back into service.
Listen, John, thank you so much. Really glad you've got her back. But what a story.
No, well, we really appreciate you reaching out to us.
Take care.
All right, you too.
John Davison is the owner of Haunted Mansion. His family owned and operated the Rainbow Valley Amusement Park on PEI. We reached him in Kensington, Prince Edward Island.
You know, I don't like owls normally, and now I do. Now
yeah, I'm distressed
them.
To learn this about you, but I'm at least that you've had an awakening.
I've warmed to them, yes. That's it was probably great. Dissecting those owl pellets in third grade, fourth grade. Anyway, that's a story for another time.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to take a short break now, but as it happens, we'll be back for you in just a moment.
When we come back, we'll go to Pakistan, where flooding has done incalculable damage to farms, and the longer it continues, the worse things could get, especially if it extends into wheat planting season.
He would pour you a double, but he was singular. A regular at the legendary New York restaurant Elaine's tells us about the late Thomas Carney, bartender extraordinaire, a man who mixed a mean drink and stopped patrons from mixing it up.
Really curious about the owl pellets, but stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
This is KWMR Point Reyes Station. I'm Aaron Harris from West Marin, West Coast, North Bay. I listen to KWMR because da-dum-bum-pa-down.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the Tuesday edition, part two. He's at the center of an enormous bribery scandal involving the U.S. Navy, and he was under house arrest in San Diego until Sunday morning when police discovered that he'd cut off his ankle bracelet and disappeared. And he's known as Fat Leonard. Leonard Francis is a Malaysian businessman. He was the key figure in a corruption scandal that cost the Navy millions of dollars. In exchange for military contracts for his company, he's alleged to have offered cash, fancy wine, lavish meals, and the services of sex workers. And now, just weeks before he was due to be sentenced, he has escaped. Craig Whitlock is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. We reached him in D.C.
Craig, how do you think the feds managed to let Fat Leonard get away?
They really took their eyes off him, believe it or not. He was on home detention, but nobody was really watching him. He had an ankle bracelet, and he slipped it and fled. And it was over our holiday weekend, so nobody was paying attention until it was too late.
But why was nobody paying attention? Because neighbors said they'd seen moving trucks coming and going over the last few weeks. He's such a high-profile person that they had in custody. Why wasn't Leonard Francis being monitored more closely?
Well, Leonard Francis is an exceptional con man, and he was actually released on bail 4 years ago for medical reasons, but he exaggerated his medical condition to a federal judge in the United States. He told her that he was dying of cancer. He does have cancer, but, you know, he's not dying, and he managed to slip his restraints. But the other very odd thing is he persuaded the judge to let him pay for his own security. So he would have a security guard outside his home 24 hours a day, along with this ankle bracelet. But Leonard was paying the security guard. So clearly the security guard didn't report the fact that he fled. And whoever was supposed to be monitoring his ankle bracelet at the federal courts wasn't paying attention over the weekend.
The supervisory deputy in this case, U.S. Marshal Omar Castillo, said, quote, he was planning this out, that's for sure. Again, did no one see this coming?
No, the irony here is that they all saw this coming 9 years ago when Leonard Francis was first arrested in San Diego. Leonard and his attorneys argued that he should get bail back then. He said he wasn't a flight risk. You know, he didn't kill anybody. He was accused of white-collar crimes. And, you know, he's 350 pounds. How could he possibly flee? But 9 years ago, the Department of Justice in the United States argued in court time and again that Leonard Francis was a flight risk and it would be easy for him to flip across the border to Mexico and catch a flight out of the country. So they all foresaw this. But because he later pleaded guilty and was a cooperating witness, I guess they came to trust him too much. And he saw his opportunity and he ran with it.
Give us a brief snapshot, if you can, of how this bribery scheme worked.
Right. So Leonard Francis owned a company called Glen Defense Marine Asia. So what they would do is they would offer services to U.S. Navy ships whenever they would visit a foreign port in Asia. They would have the contract to resupply the ship with food and fuel and water and anything else a U.S. aircraft carrier, or destroyer, or even submarines might need. At the time of his arrest, his company had contracts worth over $250 million. And at the heart of it, what Leonard did is he defrauded the U.S. government by overcharging for his services. So he would charge a ship to pump out the sewage when it would come in for a port visit for a few days. But he would exaggerate so much, he would say he pumped out 1 million gallons of sewage when the ship only had tanks for 200,000 gallons or something like this. And he bribed people in the Navy to look the other way while he defrauded them with these over-the-top excessive charges. And he did this, believe it or not, for 25 years before he got caught. He was so good at bribing people in the U.S. Navy, that's why he was able to get away with it for as long as he did.
How was he finally caught back then?
Well, again, this is the irony. There was a long-running investigation into fraud that he had committed. The problem was he was based overseas. His company was based in Singapore. He's from Malaysia originally. And they were worried that if they issued an arrest warrant or an indictment, that even if one of these other countries detained Leonard Francis, that they wouldn't extradite him. So the Justice Department cooked up a sting operation to lure Leonard to San Diego. They offered to let him meet with some important admirals at a Navy base in San Diego. And Leonard loved hanging out with admirals. He loved taking them to fancy dinners, to getting them booze, to giving them gifts and bribing them. So as soon as he came to U.S. soil, he was arrested at a hotel in San Diego almost 9 years ago to this day.
But he's gone now. What are the chances authorities will catch him a second time?
Well, I wouldn't hold my breath that they're going to catch him. Leonard's really smart. That's how he was able to get away with this for so long. And undoubtedly, he's mapped out where he can go that would make it very hard for the long arm of the law of Uncle Sam to bring him back. I'm sure he's either in Malaysia or in another country where they either don't have an extradition treaty or it would take many years to bring him back. So it's a very embarrassing case for the United States government that this highly sought-after felon who had pleaded guilty, they knew he was about to be sentenced, so he had motivation to flee. And yet, amazingly, they just stopped paying attention and let him go.
I don't know about you, but as you're telling me this story and as I read some of the other details, I'm mentally casting the limited series streaming show for this because it is incredible, all of the details. But in all seriousness, as you say, it's hard to overstate how embarrassing this must be for the Navy and for the U.S. government.
Well, it really is, but you mentioned limited series. Leonard Francis has this enormous ego. He loves media coverage, and he actually would joke around with his defense attorneys about the movie he was sure was going to be made about his life someday. He even was picking out which actors he wanted to play him. His favorite was Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Leonard has such a big ego, he was sure that he would become a big name in Hollywood someday, and you know, maybe this will make it happen.
Well, Craig, I really appreciate your time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Craig Whitlock is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. You're listening to As It Happens on CBC Radio and on PRX. And now we go from Washington, D.C. to London, U.K. Boris Johnson has said farewell in the Boris Johnsonist fashion imaginable. Today, Mr. Johnson walked out of 10 Downing Street to applause and gave his final meandering speech as the UK's Prime Minister before Liz Truss took over. The less than 10-minute address included some forceful pointing at his lectern, various passive-aggressive jabs at various people he blames for various things, and head-scratching phrases about Roman dictators and relay races. He also listed his achievements on COVID-19, Ukraine, and job numbers.
Unemployment, as I leave office, unemployment down to lows not seen since I was about 10 years old and bouncing around on a space hopper, my friends. And on the subject of bouncing around in future careers, let me say that I am now like one of those booster rockets that has fulfilled its function, and I will now be gently re-entering the atmosphere and splashing down invisibly in some remote and obscure corner of the Pacific. And like Cincinnatus, I am returning to my plough. And I will be offering this government nothing but the most fervent support. This is a tough time for the economy. This is a tough time for families up and down the country. We can and we will get through it, and we will come out stronger the other side. But I say to my fellow Conservatives, it's time for politics to be over, folks. It's time for us all to get behind Liz Truss and her team and her programme and deliver for the people of this country. Because that is what the people of this country want, that's what they need, and that's what they deserve.
Boris Johnson giving his final speech as the UK's Prime Minister today. There's a reason astronauts, and presumably aliens, have referred to Earth as the Blue Planet. After all, 71% of its surface is covered with water. But if an international team of researchers is right, a new exoplanet could make Earth look like a drop in the bucket. It is believed to be a veritable water world. For comparison, only 0.05% of Earth's mass is liquid water, while 30% of this exoplanet's mass is liquid water. Its discovery is the focus of a new paper in the Astronomical Journal, based on research led by the Université de Montréal. Charles Cadieux is a PhD student in astrophysics there and the lead author on the paper. We reached him in Montreal.
Charles, for starters, tell me what this planet, this exoplanet, is called.
Yeah, it's called TOI-1452b.
Catchy name, but significant discovery. It could be covered in water. That's what you found. What does that discovery mean to you?
It's really an intriguing planet. So we know a lot of exoplanets currently, more than 5,000 exoplanets, but a planet that can be called ocean planet, we know less than 5. So it's really a unique planet in that sense.
And just tell us what an exoplanet is.
Yeah, an exoplanet is body similar to the planet in our own solar system, but orbits a star other than the sun. So when you look during night at all the stars, the majority of those stars have planets that orbit those stars. These are called exoplanets.
So what makes you think this one is covered in water?
We had to conduct a lot of observation. One of the techniques that's called the transit technique is that we measure the light as the planet passes in front of the star. That informs us on the radius, the size of the planet. We also had to conduct other types of measurements to have an idea of its mass. And when we combine those two measurements together, we have the density of the planet. And this density is in between something that is purely rocky, made of rocks, made of metals, such as Earth, and something that is gaseous, such as the gas giants in our own solar system. And so that's the first way to infer that the main composition of this exoplanet, one of the main composition, is water.
But could it be something else?
Yeah, so in our study, we had three different possibilities for the composition of this exoplanet. But we argue that the most probable for now is maybe 20-30% of its mass must be made of water. The other possibility could be something that is rocky. So similar to Earth, it's still possible. We have to have a better idea of the mass of the planet. And another possibility is something that has a large atmosphere, but an atmosphere made of something that's really light, something like helium, something like hydrogen. But that's something also that we think it's less probable. But in the future, with other study, we will be able to confirm if it is made of water or not.
What specifically do you think it will take to prove whether this theory is true?
Yeah, so when we will be able to have a better idea on the mass, but the next important step is to study its atmosphere. So if we study the chemical properties of its atmosphere and we detect a water-rich atmosphere, that would be a good indication that water is on the surface of the planet.
The James Webb Space Telescope is going to be key for you, I believe. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the James Webb Space Telescope is the perfect instrument to conduct atmospheric studies to really constrain the chemical composition of the atmosphere.
It's a pretty competitive process, though, to get your hands on the James Webb Space Telescope, right? What is that process like?
Yeah, so usually once a year, there's a period of time we call calls for proposals. And so scientists are invited to send a really, like, a document with a justification, a scientific project, and how James Webb will be able to answer and tackle those scientific questions. And for James Webb, it's highly competitive because a lot of scientists want to use James Webb because it's one of the best observatory for now for astronomical observations. And so we will certainly ask for observation time, but also we are lucky enough, so I have some of my colleagues also that works and have time on James Webb. And if we're lucky enough, maybe we'll have some time to slot some observation on this particular exoplanet.
If it doesn't work out this year, then you have to wait another year to reapply to use the telescope. If that happens, how long could it be before you know more about the exoplanet?
Yeah, so it, as you said, it could be a few months, could be a few years. But I think when we announced the discovery of this exoplanet, there was a lot of other teams, other scientists that were really excited about this discovery, and certainly other teams will want to study it. So we're not alone on this, and that's the goal. That's the goal for everyone in my field, just to advance and know more about it and advance science in general. So it's okay.
This exoplanet, we should tell our listeners, is 100 light years from the Earth. Given what you're telling me, that how rare this is, if your discovery proves to be true, that it is covered in water, what do you think it can tell us about life in space?
So we know that water is a really crucial ingredient for life, at least on Earth as we know it. But also water is a pretty common molecule outside in the universe. So, for example, there is some moons of Jupiter and Saturn that are made of about 50% of their composition is water. So it's something that's pretty common. But if we want to advance and step by step with the ultimate goal to find life, maybe life outside of Earth, this is a really, really intriguing place to study and start to look for what we call biomarkers. So some kind of molecules that can be in the atmosphere that indicates maybe biological activity.
Charles, I really thank you for your time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Take care.
Yeah, okay.
Charles Cadieux is a PhD student in astrophysics at l'Université de Montréal and the lead author of new research in the Astronomical Journal. We reached him in Montreal. This week, for the first time since March of 2020, my co-host and I are in the same studio. And that has me feeling reflective. You know, yes, this room, Studio 321 in the CBC building in Toronto, is the As It Happens studio. But you know what? Really, this studio belongs to all of you as well. And it's an honor to share it with you. But also, our studio looks awful. Look at it. You got to help me fix it.
Dude, this is taking a turn. This is not what we talked about.
Neil, okay. You're right. No, you're right. I'm sorry. Sorry, Neil. I'm sorry, everybody. I'm just... I'm embarrassed by the state of the place.
Yeah, well, listen, the studio, our collective studio, does sound great. We know that. But I have to say, I didn't want to say too much about it. I'm new here. It does look really dull,
go
though.
Ahead,
there's
please.
Nothing yeah. on the walls. It's a really big As It Happens sign, but it's sad. It kind of looks like it was made for a charity car wash.
Yeah.
And the show has so much personality, you know, but the room, zero personality.
Yeah, there's basically nothing in here except for that one banner. But in our defense, I mean, we did kind of just move in.
Yeah, so when?
I think it's been, I don't know, like two, it's been about 2 months. Let me just ask Reynold. Reynold, when did we move in here? Right. Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, Reynold says 2010.
Oh, nice. Well done. Yeah, good on you.
Been busy, you know, for 12 years.
Right. Yeah. Obviously, we're going to have to farm this job out. So please, everyone listening, wherever you're listening from, we do need to decorate this studio. We live in here for such a big part of the day,
right?
We need your help. So please send us a postcard. Ideally, it's a postcard depicting the place where you actually live, but we will, at this point, take anything you've got. I think I might put one up. I took it from a hotel room in Turkey this summer. I never mail them. I just take them because I can.
Yeah.
But our mailing address for you is, As It Happens, Box 500, Station A, M5W1E6. Once again, As It Happens, Box 500, Station A, M5W1E6.
We appreciate anything that you send. Please. I mean, it's so boring in here. And plus, it's a chance for you to put your personal stamp on our studio. And now here's Quarter Life Crisis with Postcard from Spain.
You've been listening to As It Happens on CBC Radio. Our show is distributed in the U.S. by PRX.
You can also find us at cbc.ca/AIH. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksaw. Goodbye.
CBC Radio 1.
This is KWMR Point Reyes Station.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Indigenous villages in Alaska have begun recovery efforts after a storm devastated the state's western coastline over the weekend. On Saturday, the governor declared a disaster and is preparing to request federal assistance to help with recovery efforts. Five communities were heavily impacted, according to the state. Many others are also dealing with severe storm impacts. Communities scattered along nearly 1,000 miles of Bering and Chukchi Sea coastline saw severe flooding, damage to airport runways, loss of power, and some communities were put on boil water advisories. The storm claimed smoke houses and fish drying racks. The damage to those resources is serious. People in most of the communities impacted rely heavily on subsistence hunting and fishing for food. There have also been reports that fish, berries, and meat gathered this summer and already put away for winter has been lost. With winter fast approaching in Alaska, it's unclear how construction materials and supplies to repair damages will be delivered in communities hardest hit. The summer season to deliver these kinds of shipments by ocean barge is coming to a close. In recent years, Alaska coastal communities have seen an increase in the severity and frequency of fall season storms due to climate change. The season is only beginning. A Tlingit clan house in Sitka, Alaska, was recently returned to its home clan. Its new legal owner hopes the historic exchange will spur a greater conversation about repatriation. KCAW's Tosh Kimmel reports.
In Sitka, Alaska this July, a Kiksati clan house was repatriated after nearly 20 years in the possession of another clan. Jarek Hope Lang, a Juneau-based member of the Kiksati clan, now holds the deed. Although no longer physically standing, Hope Lang says the Point House still holds immense cultural significance.
Conceptually, we all know that we refer to our people as from the Point House. So the physical structure may not exist, but we as a people do. So the concept of the house being gone, that's just a physical structure.
Now, he plans to have the house rebuilt as a mixed-use gathering space. He hopes the revitalization of his clan house will spark a broader conversation around repatriation.
I think it starts here with this land back concept and how we identify that as individual clans beyond our tribes and how we move forward in that and act in that. I'm excited that future Kiksati children can walk into a place and say, this is my clan house.
According to the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training, there were once 43 standing clan houses in Sitka's Indian Village District. Now, only 9 remain. This would be the first 21st century clan house built in Sitka. One of the few remaining clan houses is the Porch House. Chuck Miller is its caretaker.
I remember coming into this clan house when I was a very small young child and having all my family here, family functions, meetings, food, etc. Having a clan house rebuilt here would be something pretty huge, I think, and applaud the Kiksetis for wanting to get this done and taking care of it.
After 25 years as caretaker, Miller says the Porch House is more than a building. It's a point of pride. Hope Lang wants to see the exact same thing for the Point House, for the clan house to be rebuilt now or at least in the lifetime of those generous enough to return it. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Tosh Kimmel.
The Navajo Nation on Monday issued a health advisory to inform Navajo people of 3 new confirmed cases of monkeypox on the reservation. The total number of cases is now 4. In each case, it appears the virus was caught off the reservation. The first monkeypox case on Navajo land was confirmed in August. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
There's no reason to let uncertainty about the election process keep you from voting. That's why AARP created state-specific comprehensive election guides. Learn more at aarp.org/election guides. AARP supports this show.
Did you know 1 in 26 people will develop epilepsy during their lifetime? Or that 1 in 10 people will have a seizure? Call 1-800-332-1000 to speak with an epilepsy information specialist. The Epilepsy Foundation supports this show.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.